Those are the hardships that we will give to our children if this generation does not put an end to this capitalism, this corporation, this the evolution of the free market that's killing all of us and killing our land.
They define that as proof that they don't want to turn Little Fish Lake into a toxic tailings pond.
We think that this legislation was created to allow for Jumbo Glacier Resort to zone the Jumbo Valley in any way that they choose without having to be answerable to an electorate.
All fish, every single fish, has an ecological value.
Groundware is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. It's produced bi-weekly by volunteers at community radio stations across the country. This issue was produced by CJLY, a cooperative community radio station broadcasting on Sinek's traditional territory in Nelson, BC. My name is Catherine Fisher. Welcome to the Groundwire Environmental Year in Review. In this edition, Groundwire looks back at some important environmental stories we covered in 2012, and we look ahead to 2013. 2012, the environment, was a year of protests and pipelines, omnibus federal legislation, and Idle No More. This year, Groundwire covered the Burrard Inlet Fish Festival, as well as the Athapaskan Fort Chipewyan First Nation-led protest against Shell Oil's proposed Jackpine mine in Alberta. In British Columbia, our reporters looked into Seco Mine Limited's potential slap lawsuit against the Western Canada Wilderness Committee, Klein Mining's lawsuit against the government of British Columbia, the Sinek Nation's declaration against a proposed high-end ski resort in prime grizzly bear territory in the Purcell Range, and the illegal dumping of 1,000 tons of iron sulfate off the coast of Haida Gwaii. In Ontario, we covered protests against Enbridge Incorporated's proposed Line 9 pipeline between Sarnia and Westover. We reported on the Power Shift 2012 conference held in Ottawa, and we did a story on the KI First Nations mobilization in defense of their land and environment near Big Trout Lake, north of Sioux Lookout. Groundwire reported on a blockade by members of the Uashat Malatotnam Band, taken down by the provincial police force in northern Quebec. Protesters in the blockade said they had been systematically excluded from talks related to Quebec's northern plan to develop natural resources. In Nova Scotia, we reported on protests against hydraulic fracturing or fracking in the exploratory shale gas mine near Lake Ainslie. We reported on the Freedom Train's May stop in Winnipeg as the Yinka Dene Alliance crossed the country to raise awareness about the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. We reported on several very large protests against the Enbridge pipeline, proposed to run from Bruderheim, Alberta to Kitimat, British Columbia. More than 130 First Nations and First Nation political organizations have publicly declared their opposition to the Northern Gateway project. Groundwire reporters covered the Tsleil-Waututh Nation's opposition to the twinning of the proposed Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline and the Unist'ot'en Clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation's opposition to the Pacific Trail Pipeline, planned to stretch from Summit Lake to Kitimat, British Columbia. We reported on the Omnibus Federal Budget Bill C-38 and how its contents will affect fish and fish habitat. We reported on the release of the Cohen Report about the decline of salmon in the Fraser River in BC and about how Judge Cohen's recommendations will be difficult to put into practice now that the Canadian Fisheries Act has been gutted. In December, we reported on Idle No More, how this national movement, which was started in Saskatchewan by four First Nations women out of concern about a new proposed Omnibus Federal Bill, C-45, will further weaken Canadian environmental regulations. The Idle No More mission statement calls on all people to join a revolution which honors and fulfills Indigenous sovereignty, which protects the land and the water. In this episode of Groundwire, we'll review some of these stories and provide updates on some of these important happenings. In April 2012, the Omnibus Budget Bill C-38 was presented before Canada's Parliament, and in June 2012, the bill was brought into law. Named the Jobs Growth and Long-Term Prosperity Act, C-38 introduced, amended, and repealed 70 federal laws in a single bill. The 400-plus page bill had a huge impact on federal environmental law. According to the organization West Coast Environmental Law, C-38 has weakened protection for fish and species at risk, weakened environmental assessment law, provided broad decision-making powers for cabinet and ministers, weakened public accountability, and provided the public and First Nations groups with fewer opportunities for public participation in decision-making. The bill changed some regulations that constrain the National Energy Board, removing, for example, the requirement to consider critical habitat or species at risk issues. The National Energy Board regulates pipelines and other infrastructure projects in Canada. Where a major energy project is subject to a National Energy Board hearing, a Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency-enabled review panel is prohibited, so there'll be no more joint review panels. Thus, the environmental implications of major energy projects will now be evaluated only by the energy regulator. Broad decision-making powers have been given to cabinet and individual ministers. This means decisions related to fish habitat protection and environmental assessments will be allowed to be made behind closed doors with minimal public scrutiny. A significant narrowing of public engagement in resource review panel hearings, particularly for major oil projects, pipelines, and mines, is now allowed. In order to participate, people will have to prove they will be directly affected or have relevant information or expertise. These changes to the environmental review process will violate the government's obligation to consult with First Nations and accommodate First Nation treaty and Aboriginal rights. One of the laws changed by the passing of C-38 was Canada's Fisheries Act. Groundwire discussed some of the issues affecting fish and fish habitat over the past year. In April of 2012, before the changes to the Fishery Act were brought into law, Catherine Fisher of CJLY in Nelson spoke with spokesperson for Senecas Nation in Canada, Marilyn James. James spoke about what should be considered in any legislation that would effectively protect fish and fish habitat.
I think that the Fisheries Act needs to consider hardcore management strategies around habitat and habitat restoration. And I think until those issues are solved, they should not be allowing for any development that compromises the fisheries that exist now. I think extensive studies should be done, not just to the big species in a water system, but to the smallest species in the water system, and that the management strategies should revolve around those small species in the water system. If they're doing fine, the larger species are going to do fine. And I think their strategies around introduction of different species into different water systems all have to be suspended. And, of course, ideas like fracking have got to be completely taken out of any kind of development.
Unfortunately, the government went in the opposite direction and provided fish-fish habitat and waterways with less protection rather than more. Among Canadian scientists and First Nations, there is broad consensus that the changes that have been made to the Fisheries Act will dramatically weaken protections to fish habitat in lakes, streams, and waterways across the country, protections that many feel are already too weak. On August 11th, after changes to the Fisheries Act were written into law, Jay Peachy, an artist and advocate on behalf of wild salmon, organized the Burrard Inlet Fish Festival in Port Moody, B.C. Nick Panu of CJSF in Burnaby spoke with the musician Os 12 at the festival for the September 12th episode of Groundwire.
Happy to be here at Fish Fest.
How important was it for you personally to be here at this festival and perform?
For me, it's very important to come to Fish Fest because my people have lived in this area forever. I'm a Coast Salish Stalo member. Also, my family's just from Coquitlam over here. Coquitlam is actually my grandfather's name. So that's pretty important. And our people have always sustained our lives with salmon and seafood. And the environment is very important to us. So to come and raise awareness with music and be able to play music on stage for people, to me, is awesome. I can't imagine a world without salmon. And that's, I mean, we already had a year where we didn't catch any. And that's crazy. I used to be able to just be like, hey, can I have a fish? And my cousins would hook it up. But now it's not like that.
On October 31st of this year, the 1,200-page report of the Cohen Commission of Inquiry into the Decline of Salmon in the Fraser River was released. The Cohen report cited many issues as factors in the declining of salmon, ranging from conflict of interest in the Department of Fisheries and Oceans to the impact of climate change to Ottawa's weakening of protection for sockeye salmon in Bill C-38. In the report, Cohen provides 75 specific recommendations to improve the health of the sockeye population, many dealing with ongoing and increasing research and monitoring of fish and habitat and complete implementation of the 1986 habitat policy. In Groundwire's November 20th edition, Vanessa Vivial of CKUT in Montreal, Quebec, spoke with Terence Costa, a Vancouver campaigner with the Wilderness Committee, about the Cohen Inquiry and report, and about how Parliament's approval of Bill C-38 will make the implementation of Cohen's recommendations to increase protection for sockeye salmon very difficult.
What's alarming is that, dating back, key example is the budget bill, C-38, that was passed in the House of Commons in June of this year, which essentially gutted the budget for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, laid off a third of the habitat protection staff for wild salmon. How can we be finding out as much as we can about these fish, about how to protect them, about how to ensure that we have healthy runs into the future when we're cutting funding? It's not what Cohen recommends, and it's not what we recommend.
That was Nelson, BC artist Rylan Kewen with part of his piece Depth Wobbler. You're listening to Groundwire Community Radio News from coast to coast to coast. This is a special edition of the program, our Groundwire Environmental Year in Review. Pipelines and pipeline protests were huge environmental stories this year. Throughout the course of 2012, you documented some of the protests and the issues surrounding the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline Project, the Pacific Trail Pipeline Project, the Enbridge Line 9 Pipeline Project, and the Trans Mountain Pipeline Project. The Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipelines Project proposes to construct a twin pipeline running from Bruderheim, Alberta to Kitimat, British Columbia. Because the project crosses a provincial boundary, it requires public regulatory review process, which is conducted by the Joint Review Panel. The first Joint Review Panel session was held on January 10, 2012 in Kitimat Village, British Columbia. Hearings are expected to continue until May 2013. The organization West Coast Environmental Law maintains a list of more than 130 First Nations and First Nation political organizations that have publicly declared their opposition to the Enbridge tankers and pipeline projects. In January 2012, Ed Von Otterkass of CHRW in London, Ontario, brought Groundwire an interesting story about how both Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Natural Resource Minister Joe Oliver attributed opposition to the pipeline to foreign-backed extremists. Here's Ed speaking with Council of Canadians Energy and Climate Change Officer Andrea Harden-Donoghue.
So number one, I find that quite disconcerting. Number two, I think it's quite interesting that they're really pointing the fingers at NGOs who receive U.S.-based foundation money, yet no questions are being asked about the influence of foreign multinational corporations and their interests being brought forward in this regulatory review. No questions are being asked about the millions of dollars being spent on lobbying the federal government or the close relationship between the federal government and the oil industry. And little is being said to recognize that this is one of the first times we've seen a huge number of people, concerned citizens as well as NGOs and groups, come forward and want to voice their opinions in a democratic process.
In early May, First Nations people from Alberta, Northern BC, and all along the West Coast made their way across Canada on the train to an Enbridge shareholders meeting in Toronto to raise awareness about the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. Michael Welch from CKUW spoke with the group during their stop in Winnipeg. Here's Vice President of Haida Nation, April Churchill, from the June 23rd edition of Groundwire.
Take a look around the world at people who do not have water. Look at the hardship of their children. Those are the hardships that we will give to our children if this generation does not put an end to this capitalism, this corporation, this the evolution of the free market that's killing all of us and killing our land.
Enbridge Inc. claims it has the support of 60% of the First Nations along the proposed BC-Alberta route of the Northern Gateway Pipeline. Art Starrett, Executive Director of Coastal First Nations, an alliance of First Nations along BC's north and central coast and Haida Gwaii, says that's not true. Up next is part of a report from Red Eye Collective of Vancouver Co-op Radio, which originally aired in July 2012 on Groundwire.
We've learned just recently that Enbridge has been fighting with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans now since 2010, and they lobbied the government something like 40 times last year, and as a result of that, we are now getting Fisheries Act changes to allow them to do whatever they want. They have no respect for water. They have no respect for rivers, and they couldn't beat the rules that were in place, so they've got the government to change them, and we saw all that in Parliament this week. So we're in for a big battle in British Columbia, but we're up to the challenge. British Columbians and First Nations are not going to allow this to happen. And the one thing that British Columbians can take heart with is the fact that all of these laws that were changed in Ottawa have not changed the Aboriginal rights and title of First Nations in British Columbia. And we will use those rights to make sure that the environment that British Columbians respect and cherish are going to be there for future generations.
In October 2012, Groundwire coordinator Aaron Hunter reported in a headline about a large protest against the Northern Gateway project at the BC Legislature in Victoria. In the December 16th edition of Groundwire, Aaron Hunter reported on the Joint Review Panel's ruling that spectators will have to watch the Enbridge Northern Gateway hearings in Victoria from 3 kilometres away. Enbridge hearings will continue in 2013, starting in Victoria on January 4th, where they are expected to continue until January 11th. The Vancouver hearings will span from January 14th to February 1st, and hearings will then move to Kelowna for February 28th, 2013.
Stay so elusive to most everything. What occurs to me, you are not thinking. Winding the wind call through the trees, finding a way.
Groundwire covered a story in our December 17th edition that had important environmental law implications. A bit of background on the story. Abitibi Bowater was Canada's third largest pulp and paper company. It filed for insolvency protection in 2009, leaving behind sites contaminated by the company's mining, shipping, and pulp and paper operations in Newfoundland and Labrador. Because Abitibi Bowater declared bankruptcy, the question of who must pay to clean up these contaminated sites moved through 3 levels of court, ending up in the Supreme Court of Canada. This groundbreaking case represented the first time Canada's insolvency law has confronted the well-established polluter pays principle. The polluter pays is among the most important environmental law concepts in Canada. It's the basic idea behind cleanup orders, penalties, and cost recovery decisions. Implementing polluter pays involves polluters taking responsibility for remedying contamination for which they're responsible and imposes upon them a direct and immediate cost of pollution. The case was complicated because the government of Newfoundland had accidentally expropriated contaminated sites from Abitibi Bowater when it passed legislation seizing the company's land and energy assets in 2008. The Supreme Court published a ruling in the case on December 7th acknowledging the polluter pay principle, but the decision said in this case the province had no special status among the company's creditors. Therefore, Newfoundland would have to line up for money from the company, a process which has, unfortunately, already been finalized. Aaron Hunter of CKUT spoke with Beatrice Olivesti, CEO of the environmental organization Friends of the Earth, about the case in the December 16th edition of Groundwire. Friends of the Earth intervened in the proceedings through their legal wing, EcoJustice. The organization argued that the law requires insolvent corporations to retain their environmental obligations through a restructuring process and said that companies must not burden taxpayers with the cost of cleaning up contaminated sites. Unfortunately, the court found that Abitibi Bowater was not responsible for cleanup in this case. The end result is that, should the province of Newfoundland decide to clean up the sites, the province's taxpayers will bear most of the costs associated with cleaning up these sites. In the GroundWare interview, Olaf Estee puts forward some lessons learned as a result of this process.
Regulating in real time, enforcing regulations in real time, and requiring that cleanup as identified, is really critical so that we don't end up in this situation with companies that try to walk away, and that's what we think Abitibi's done. And the other thing is that we think when licenses and permits are being issued, that governments should be at that time assessing likely pollution. Many of these natural resource processes cause pollution by their nature. But by assessing that when the license and permit is issued, whether it's insurance or a bond or something else, one, we think taxpayers will be protected from the cost of cleanup, and two, we think it will influence the companies to use the most advanced pollution abatement technologies then.
And as an update to this story, efforts by the province to find a use for the former mill site in central Newfoundland remain unrealized, and Abitibi Bowater has restructured, and they are now operating in the province as Resolute Forest Products. According to equities research analysts at BMO Capital Markets, released on December 17th, Resolute Forest Products had revenue of $1.15 billion for this quarter. Buffy St. Marie, originally from Capel Valley, Saskatchewan, with Working for the Government from her 2008 album Running for the Drum. You're listening to GroundWire, a national news magazine produced by campus and community radio stations across Canada. This is our special 2012 GroundWire Environmental Year in Review edition. Our next story has to do with Bill C-45 and the Idle No More movement. Idle No More was initiated by activists Nina Wilson, Sheila McLean, Sylvia McAdam, and Jessica Gordon in November 2012, when the four started organizing teach-ins in Saskatoon, Regina, and Prince Albert to start bringing awareness to Bill C-45, an omnibus bill approved by the Canadian Senate on the last day of the 2012 parliamentary session. Bill C-45 will become law in 2013. Like Bill C-38, C-45 is a large omnibus bill containing changes to many laws, in this case including the Fisheries Act, the Indian Act, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, the Navigable Waters Protection Act, and the Employment Insurance Act. In the December 16th edition of GroundWire, CKUT's Aaron Hunter talks about the growing national movement that is Idle No More and describes changes to the Navigable Waters Act and some implications of these changes.
Actions have been occurring across the country identifying themselves as part of the Idle No More movement, one of which is a hunger strike by Chief Teresa Spence, which we'll hear about later in the show. Another aspect of Bill C-45 are the changes to the Navigable Waters Protection Act, some of Canada's oldest legislation dating back to 1882. The former legislation stated waterways could not be blocked, altered, or destroyed without federal approval if water was deep enough for a canoe to float. Previously, 40,000 lakes and 2.5 million rivers were protected. Now, 97 lakes and 62 rivers are protected. Potential implications for the waterways now outside of federal jurisdiction include the new development or expansion of projects such as pipelines or power lines, where the companies responsible will no longer have to justify before a federal government audience how they will avoid damaging these waterways. These decisions will now fall predominantly to the National Energy Board.
This from the Idle No More website. The continued imposition of federal legislation on Indigenous peoples and governments is not in line with the legal principles of acting in good faith and maintaining the honor of the Crown. There are many nations taking actions to reflect acts of Indigenous statehood, sovereignty, and jurisdiction in response to the passing of legislation such as Bill C-45, and we must continue on this path. When we stand strong and believe in our ways and assert acts of nationhood, it does not matter what amount of legislation the federal government introduces or passes, because it is not with our consent and therefore it is not applicable. We close this feature on Idle No More with a recording courtesy of the Halifax Media Co-op. This was recorded at a gathering in Halifax on December 14th.
For coming here tonight. I wasn't sure, there are so many Facebook people that are coming, but it's beautiful, beautiful people here all gathered here today. And we're speaking on one thing, that we have a voice, we count in this country, and this government needs to recognize that we do count, and we have to be consulted with properly on issues that are going to affect us. Isn't that right, Mi'kmaq? I want to acknowledge as well that we are on Mi'kma'ki. In our territory here, we welcome everyone. It is these children here that is absolutely the number one reason we need to stay united and stand together. I want to thank all the chiefs, acknowledge the chiefs here today, all the elders, all our youth, all our women, all our men, all our supporters. Every Canadian here needs to be our partner. Is the government and its way of business we do have a problem with. We never had a problem with coexisting with Canadians. We were open and shared our land and resources, and we believe we can coexist. But we will not allow legislation and suppression amongst our people on policies that do not work for us, and we will start standing together at actions like this. And all across the country, we will stand together with our brothers and sisters, the Cree, the Ojibwe, the Dene, the Mohawk, Iroquois, and so forth.
You've been listening to Groundwire. This episode was produced on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, BC by Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks to the Halifax Media Co-op, Aaron Hunter and Vanessa Vial at CKUT, Michael Welch at CKUW, Ed Von Otterkass from CHRW, Vancouver Co-op Radio's Red Eye Collective, and Nick Panu of CJSF. Music in this episode was by Ryland Kewen, Pauline Lamb, and Buffy St. Marie. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. If you'd like to contribute to Groundwire, please check out our website at groundwire.ncra.ca.